the dark days are done and the bright days are here. My sunny one shines so sincere. Sunny one so true.
Our next guest is one of those rare talents who has something to say and can say it funny. He's a writer-performer on the new Laugh-In and one of the most popular, outspoken, and entertaining personalities on the local news here in Los Angeles. He's won a half a dozen Emmys as a film critic and host of his own shows. Let's welcome Mr. John Barber, right over there.
Thank you. This is John Barber. That was Syreeta singing Sonny and Frank Sinatra saying, "Here's Johnny," the night he took over The Tonight Show and had me on as a guest. Welcome to John Barber's World, live here in Las Vegas, America's only 24-hour town, a one-of-a-kind town built by gamblers who were sadly looking for four of a kind. You know, you've all seen it. For days, the internet has been awash with people worrying that Trump will launch nukes on Korea or Putin or someone else's hotel. It is not Trump, folks. It is the system, which already offed John Kennedy for getting in the way of what Gorg Vidal called perpetual war. But people need not worry, folks. Humans will survive. We are a larger form of cockroach, as Mark Twain said. For me, though, since Trump has become president, and by the way, am I the only one who's noticed this? But almost every single reporter on network news never refers to him as president. They all call him Mr. Trump. Anyway, ever since Mr. Trump became president, I can thank him for bringing my electricity bill down. Whenever the news comes on, I turn it off. And speaking of real news, Mark Crispin Miller announced today that they've just proven that Trump is not Putin's puppet. He is the Pentagon's puppet. You know, when I want the real news, I read Joe Satilli's News Vandal or tune into my guest show, the Project Censored Show, which originates from Pacific Radio and is heard on 40 stations around the country. He is co-host along with Professor Peter Phillips, former director of Project Censored. My guest is a current director of what is the most important bastion of real news in America. Every year, he edits and contributes to an absolute must-read 25 of the most censored, unreported stories. A few shockers we will try to touch on tonight. $3 billion paid to families damaged by vaccines. FBI spying on high school students, the Walmarting of education, and America's hidden sex trafficking in underage girls and why they need to keep fossil fuels left in the ground. It is a privilege to welcome the voice of real American journalism, president of the Media Freedom Foundation and professor of social sciences and history at Diablo Valley College, Mickey Huff. Mickey, thank you so much for being here. I deeply, deeply appreciate it, and so does the audience, I assure you. They are thrilled that you are here.
Thank you, John. It's an honor and pleasure to be on with you. Thanks again for having us.
Okay, now, I'm going to ask this. If a lot of these stories are censored, how do you find them?
That's a fantastic question, John. Well, since we were founded in 1976, Project Censored's definition of censorship has been a fairly simple one, but on the face of it, it challenges what many people think about censorship. Historically and traditionally, people tend to think about censorship as a government thing, something that where they sort of reach out with a big hand and kill the story before it's ever published to make it censored. So it seems reasonable enough. However, censorship is actually anything that interferes with the free flow of information in a society that purports to have free press principles. So censorship is often by degree. It's sliding of content with omission, or it's framing, or it's false balancing, or it's attacking and labeling, right? So in many cases, censorship happens as a result of relentless propaganda campaigns, or as we've recently seen in the last year, the infatuation among establishment media and politicians with the phrase fake news. If there's nothing new about fake news or propaganda, both of which are different forms of censorship, and what we do is we look for underreported and stories that don't get the attention of the corporate media, the six corporations that control 90% in the United States. So these are stories that are published by intrepid independent journalists, yet they don't get very much attention. And our students at the 20 campuses we work at nationwide, we have a couple hundred students, a couple dozen professors. We work both through Project Censored, ACME, and also the Global Critical Media Literacy Project, where we have people reviewing stories year-round that then validate them. It's called a validated independent news story, which means they fact-check it, they cover it for significance and breadth and depth, and they then look on LexisNexis or ProQuest as part of an assignment or something that we do in classes, and they verify where the story has or hasn't been covered. And if it has been covered in corporate media, we have the students go over and analyze how it's been covered. We review it with professors that are experts in the subject areas, and it gets on a list. And at the end of spring every year on our cycle, we have a list of our expert judges, about 30 of them, that go through and look at these, and the professors and the students and the judges go ahead and vote on these. But the shorter answer then is these are things that actually get published in places, or else we'd never know about them, unless it were things like WikiLeaks.
Okay, speaking of never knowing, you and I know there are a lot of really good journalists in this country, and a lot of them still aspiring to be Ed Murrows of the future, working at the networks, who probably run into great stories that are squashed. For example, Joe Satilli, who's a huge fan of yours. He writes his daily News Vandal.
Oh, yeah. He's excellent. Does great work.
He was an award winner at PBS back in Washington, D.C., and he did this great story, this hour story about depleted uranium. PBS got a note from the Pentagon that didn't want it aired, so it wasn't aired, and they parted company with Joe. Are there people still employed at the networks who run into these roadblocks and they call Mickey Huff and they say, hey, Mickey, we cannot tell this story?
You know, a lot of the people that we talk to, many people have been through the networks, but I tell you, John, if you really want to do journalism and you really want to be a classic, you know, kind of muckraking truth teller, then your days at the networks are increasingly numbered, and it's gotten worse over the years. And, you know, a couple classic examples of that over the last couple of decades. One, of course, is Gary Webb, the late great Gary Webb, and the crack cocaine story, and how the San Jose Mercury News and the Washington Post and the corporate media railroaded him into obscurity and ruined his life. And, you know, the other one who's rebounded, of course, on a more positive note, that's one of my favorite former network journalists, was Christina Borgeson. And, you know, from Feet to the Fire and, you know, the work that she's done post 9/11 and the project she's doing now, I think she's really stellar. She's morphed herself into documentary film and TWA 800 and many of the other things she's done. She does stellar things. But you know what we learn from these people, John, is that we learn that corporate media has the veneer of telling people what's going on while simultaneously winnowing it, framing it, and sidelining and tabling it. I mean, even Dan Rather has told these stories of what you can and can't do in corporate news media. So it's frankly a disgrace. And also, being on Pacifica, one would think it's so-called free speech radio out of Berkeley, California, there are also pressures there to not report upon or not tell certain kinds of stories, because there's censorship on the left, and there's certainly censorship among the foundation sort of addicted left to that kind of funding. So we find people from all walks of journalism that are doing fantastic work, John, and we don't care necessarily where they are or where they used to be. What we're glad about is that people still have the need and the drive to do journalism and to dig deeply and shine light in dark places. And our book, every year by Seven Stories Press, highlights 25 of those stories along with media analysis, and that's after going through and collecting some 200 of these stories throughout the year.
Well, there are a few that I want to talk about in a minute, but first of all, I don't think I could justifiably talk about them unless we talk about what has happened in this last week. Do you think there are some censored stories or uncovered stories about what is going on between Trump and North Korea? As a matter of fact, the Russian press reported today that Putin is reported to have said that the president of the United States is more dangerous than the president of North Korea. But do you think there's something going on that we aren't being told about Korea and Syria? Because it is highly unlikely that Assad gassed his own people.
Well, as we found out in 2013, John, back, you know, particularly the work of Cy Hirsch, you know, who broke at My Lai and has done stellar reporting since, really flipped that on its ear in Syria with the regime change crowd. And quite frankly, there's been some journalists on the progressive end of the spectrum that's reporting has been abysmal on Syria, with just unquestioning reporting about how great the white helmets are without acknowledging them as a propaganda organ of the West or NATO and so forth. So I'm sure there are plenty of things going on that we don't know about, but it's sad to see such conformity in terms of consensus in the corporate media about the gas attacks in Syria. We saw the same kind of shoddy reporting going on with Libya. North Korea is just perpetually demonized. The fact is that you likely get very little information about what's going on with that. But what we do know regarding what's happening in Syria and in the North Korean peninsula, and also in Afghanistan, where we just dropped a huge MOAB, like a massive bomb, the largest non-nuclear
since Japan.
Do you want to
know something? I found the presses and the government's naming of that bomb, the mother of all bombs,
that's absolutely misogynistically
offensive.
Insulting.
I mean,
it's misogynistic, and it's complete nonsense. And by the way, the major corporate papers like the New York Times call it the mother of all bombs, even though that's technically not what the acronym stands for, which is an absolutely offense to anything feminine. I mean, it's a completely misogynistic co-optation of motherhood and mothers. Los Angeles Times, the bomb was just on its own agency. Nobody even dropped it. It's just the bomb just found its way to the target. So there's no agency. So it's pretty disgusting the way in which media frame that.
If I were Bill Hicks, I would say if they want to give it a name like that, they should call it the mother-in-law of all bombs.
Yeah, I miss Bill Hicks.
Oh, you know, I was a professional comic myself for years, and I didn't notice Bill much. But my son, who was 12, said, "Dad, you must listen to Bill Hicks." And I said, "Who's Bill Hicks?" And I must tell you, he is featured in we have just done an unbelievable documentary, Mickey, called, it's part two of the Garrison Takes. It's called The American Media and the Second Assassination of President John F. Kennedy. It opens May 26th at the Music Hall Theater in Beverly Hills, and I hope you would get to see it. But
love to get to see it.
Yes. It is how the media destroyed Jim Garrison, and we have all this documentation, and the media ends up burying
itself. It's what they do. To Sirhan. It's what they did to William Pepper. It's what they did to James Earl Ray. It's what they do to all of the pasties in the Fall Guys. Yeah, you know, we just interviewed William Pepper not long ago about the plot to kill King and what we now know about this. And that's the media's job. They're character assassins. The CIA, back after the Warren Commission report in Memo 1035-960, ordered their Mockingbird journalists to demonize people with the conspiracy theory label. And they've taken that clue ever since to demonize anybody that has the temerity to address the deep state propaganda that we're inundated by in the CIA's mighty Wurlitzer media world.
Well, it's astonishing that you mentioned that, because, you know, I interviewed Mr. Garrison, gave me a 3-hour interview. It was only his only interview in 10 years following the Clay Shaw trial because of all the distortions that he felt in the press. But I had been trying for 10 years since 1970. I booked him on the AM show, the number one show in Los Angeles, after he wrote Heritage of Stone, his recounting of the Clay Shaw trial. I was fired. He told me not to book him. He said, "You'll get fired." And I was fired, and he was canceled. But in any event, in the documentary, This is how smart this man was. In investigating the assassination of John Kennedy, he investigated the history of the CIA and how it was set up and ran into Project Mockingbird, which you just mentioned. And we name all the people at the networks and the newspapers who embraced the Central Intelligence Agency's Project Mockingbird. And the bird they were mocking, of course, was the American Eagle. So I can't wait for you to see the film, but I also can't wait for you to comment on something. I have a lot of mothers who are fans on Facebook who are concerned about vaccines, and I don't know anything mm-hmm. about that. I read Dr. Mary mm-hmm. Spunky that talked about vaccines.
Yeah, of course.
People polio. But I was astonished that your story, it was in brackets, I think you call it the vaccine court, where $3 billion was awarded to families damaged by vaccines?
Well, this is another one of these stories that people don't understand very clearly. And let's, of course, break through the fog of corporate media propaganda and big pharma. They love to use a term of anybody that brings up anything at all that could be slightly critical about not just vaccines, but mandatory vaccine policy that violates people's civil rights to an education or Roe v. Wade rights to personal autonomy over their bodies. And this story is actually about the VAERS court. It's about a vaccine court that was created in the mid-late 1980s. Many people do not know this, including several attorneys and lawyers and people that later, you know, had children that were victims of vaccines. They had adverse reactions to vaccines. And granted, most people do not have adverse reactions to vaccines. So this is not an anti-vaccine story, but that's just the big pharma propaganda, that anybody that brings this up is tarred and feathered as a lunatic, and then they trot out Jenny McCarthy, or they trot out flat earthers or whatever. And this is absolute nonsense. What the problem here is this. Congress gave immunity to an entire industry that makes vaccines such that they can never be liable for it. And there's a small surcharge on each vaccine that goes to fill this fund. And over 4,000 people have received a total of $3.5 billion in compensation over the last several decades. Now, I realize that that's a small number, but many of the people that sign up for compensation never get it. First of all, most people don't know it exists, and most doctors don't know it exists, so they can't even tell people about it if there's an adverse reaction, and their initial reaction is to deny and delay, right? And so when we do see that there's a problem, there aren't very many mechanisms for people to get recourse for liability. And the reason that this story is so important is because it shows that, look, no one size fits all, and people should not necessarily be put on mandatory schedules or be denied rights to an education, which is the case in California through SB 277, which was put through by Dr. Richard Pan, a state senator who receives the largest amount of money from Big Pharma in Sacramento in California. I'm going to repeat this again for listeners. This is not an anti-vaccine story. This is a pro-consumer rights story, and it's a pro-medical rights story. And the fact that Congress 30 plus years ago gave immunity to an entire industry for any harm that they do in the future because Big Pharma blackmailed them and said they would no longer manufacture these things, that's an absolute travesty that people don't know about it. And we covered that story. It's our number 13 story in Censored 2017, which is our 40th anniversary book. And I urge people, to look into the story. It was covered in Cronkite News. It was covered actually on NPR, of all places. They did one story on this. That's why we say these are underreported stories. But again, by far, there was a story even that the Marin Independent Journal did. And Marin, the wealthy county north of San Francisco, was one of the great cheerleaders for the mandatory vaccine bill. And even they covered this story as being an issue. Because, we are missing some other stories that go along with this that include consumer rights, the rights to an education. And what about Handmaid's Tale? What about the state? The state should not have the right to force compulsory medical treatments, which is what Senator Pan is now doing through SB 18. They're trying to make it legal in California for the state to enter your home and intervene in parenting, up to and including even make your children wards of the state if you do not follow the lead of the state in determining what is best for your child medically, educationally, et cetera. It is a massive Pandora's box and a slippery slope, and it's a form of liberal fascism that California is unfortunately becoming more familiar with.
Mickey, you have just uttered two words that we almost never, ever hear again. Consumer rights. Whatever happened to them?
Ralph Nader, man, big fan of mine, personal friend and hero. And I'll tell you, this is a consumer rights story, and we need to hear more about these things. And hey, don't forget, Ralph Nader has a radio show on Pacifica, and his new book, Breaking Through Power, is phenomenal as a way of regaining more power and rights, not just as voters and citizens, but as consumers, because unfortunately we do live in a vastly capitalist system run by the transnational capitalist class, and that's a reality. So we need to have these kinds of protections in order to maintain any kind of semblance of safety or security or peace of mind.
The other story that sent chills through me was your story. I mean, it almost sounds like a Peter Sellers movie about the FBI spying on children in high school.
Oh, my God.
Tell me about that.
Well, this was the FBI's new plan to spy on high school students across the country. Sarah Lazare, she's a great independent journalist that does work at Alternet. And also justsecurity.org. Danielle Jeffries did a great story on this. Ken Burrows, our professor at San Francisco State, and student Brandy Maselli researched this story. It's a fantastic example of McCarthyism just gone utterly awry post 9/11. The idea that we now somehow have to target, and you know where this is going, we have to target and basically profile, you know, hotbeds of extremism, U.S. high schools. That's right. We're not talking about the keg party or making out under the bleachers at the football game. We're talking about how young people have inherent factors where they can be risky. They can be ideal targets to be manipulated. They can also be radicalized through things like the internet. That's a pretty big statement. But again, it's profiling Muslims, it's profiling immigrants.
Mickey, are you concerned about the internet and what may happen to it?
I'm concerned about net neutrality, indeed. I think that source should be wide open. It should be accessible to all. It should be a true democratic small d medium for communication. And even in the throes of the fears of fake news, we should have critical media literacy education, not censors, not blacklists. We don't need corporate net control. They only need that to control what we think and to control what our options are, and to corral us into being consumers of products we don't need or that are slowly killing us. We
this
need an open internet,
FBI,
and we need to have this.
This story about the FBI, which
it's riveting.
The FBI is fear-mongering.
They're actually working with principals and others. I mean, they're actually turning teachers and principals into potential snitches or spies on certain students. And, of course, you know, they are targeting people, right?
Does that not sound, as Jim Garrison said, you know, after the House Select Committee concluded that four shots had been fired because they found a dicta belt that recorded the multiple shots, the House Select Committee said there were conspiracies in the killing of John Kennedy and Martin Luther King. And Garrison says in the documentary, it's not even reported. And then he goes on to say it is like Hitler's Germany in the 30s. Now, you having teachers and principals spying on kids sounds like brown shirts in the 30s.
Yeah, it's basically, you know, the Dare to Keep Kids Off Drugs program, like on steroids, gone awry in a country that has gotten so xenophobic and paranoid and uses 9/11 as an excuse to crack down on everything from education to liberties to where budgets go and so on. That's why we thought this story was really significant, that it's in fact now the FBI is working with these schools to... But look, we're talking about minors here. We're talking about minors. And by the way, if you know Trevor Aronson, who worked in the Terror Factory, one of our stories from a few years ago was on how the FBI was training. The FBI was actually responsible for most of the terrorist plots that they subsequently foiled by targeting people that were in marginalized groups and doing these kind of things.
Okay, Mickey, that brings up two things. You talk about minors. You have two other great articles. One of them is the Walmarting. What a great verb, the Walmarting of education.
Yes, it's a gerund.
tell me about that one.
Well, look, we've been, since the 70s and 80s, under the hypnotic spell that everything public is bad and everything private is good. Thank you, Milton Friedman. And under that guise, education falls. And over the years, public education has been attacked. Teachers have been attacked, mostly to get rid of unions, since the teachers' unions were so strong once upon a time. But this story is about, again, it's about educational, quote, reform, right? And this story originally was also an alternate, how the cutthroat Walmart business model is reshaping American public education. And basically, this was a plan where, that not only is Walmart, again, they're closing stores and these kind of things, but they're also they're spending their vast profits on K-12 education, where they have created the Walmart Family Foundation, and they are trying to donate money to charter schools, and they're trying to change the face of what public education looks like by, in fact, destroying it. And they're trying to turn it into places where there aren't teacher unions, there aren't protections for students. It's pretty riveting. They're essentially turning education into a widget factory where we pump out children that take tests, don't learn how to think critically, and become great automatons in the workplace. So the Walmarting of education couldn't be really any better title. It's pretty amazing. And we're talking about billions of dollars.
It's a truly Orwellian story. Now, I live in a town where quite often we hear about sex trafficking amongst minors, and you figure, well, in a town like Las Vegas, where money is their god and their goddess, I can sort of understand that. But I was again astonished by the amount of information you had in the other story about America's hidden sex trafficking in underage girls. I mean, it almost looked like it's an epidemic.
Yeah, that's not hyperbolic of you to say, John. There's only 4,000 to 5,000 cases that are reported to the National Human Trafficking Resource Center hotline. But so many of these things are underreported. And, I mean, these include, of course, this is something that happens around major cities, major sporting events, et cetera. About seven, eight years ago, it's estimated that it was upwards of $290, $300 million going on. And if you take a look and you look at this internationally, but look at international sex slaves in the United States, the conservative estimate, believe it or not, is that there are somewhere in the neighborhood of close to 4 million girls and young women that are involved in this. And this is not to be conflated with prostitution, by the way. I want to be very clear about that these are not people that are considered sex workers. These are people that are taken, and they are pushed into this world of sex slavery. And this is happening under our noses in the United States. And look, I don't want to open up too big of a can of worms here, but when we live in a society where people like Jeffrey Epstein, down at his Pleasure Island over there in the Caribbean,
yes,
his vulture hedge funder, where he had Bill Clinton going there without Secret Service people, Donald Trump was there umpteen times with his fetishistic worship of children and pedophilia. I'm not exaggerating, and that is not hyperbolic. That is exactly what this guy was ultimately convicted for, and this is something that happens. And so the sex trade issue is really important in the United States, I believe, because most people don't see it as a sex trade industry or a slavery industry. They mostly see it as sex workers and prostitutes, and that's a different subject than this one.
Oh, my goodness gracious. That is absolutely startling. And then, of course, since we live in an extremely capitalistic system, it seems to be getting worse and worse, where the 1% select the president and the 99% are left to try to elect them. You have, again, this closing story about why they are keeping or want to keep fossil fuels in the ground.
Well, look, this is the ticking clock that's been going on for so long. And, we even know now that Exxon and Shell and others 4 decades ago, through their own research, knew that by further extracting and refining fossil fuels, that they were contributing to global warming and contributing to a global catastrophe that would affect millions and ultimately could affect billions of people, not to mention the entire ecosystem and life on Earth as we know it. So this is a solution. A lot of the stuff we do with the project, of course, highlight problems that go on, but we also focus on what are some things that can be done about it. This story focuses on that. and says, hey, listen, we need to stop this yesterday. It's going to continue to get worse even after we stop it. But we have to move in the direction of countries like Germany. We have to move in the direction of countries like Costa Rica, who often runs their country on totally renewable energy for 3 months at a time. And I know Costa Rica is smaller than the United States or even Germany, but there are ways to do it. But we need to get rid of the money in politics, and we need to get rid of the lobbying of the fossil fuel industry, and they need to be pushed and forced to leave this oil in the ground, and they need to shift to renewable energies. And until, you said it before, John, we live in a capitalist world, capitalist society, if we don't change that and make it profitable to do renewable energy, we may not be here in 50 years. And again, that's also not a hyperbolic statement.
I
know there are a lot of people working on this.
Mickey, am I correct in this? I believe I read about 6 months ago, I believe it was Colombia, added a constitutional amendment requiring people to protect the environment. Am I right?
That was all. I don't remember Colombia, but I think that has happened in Ecuador, and that is on the palette in many South American countries. And yes, that's right, that nature has rights. And I guess that puts a whole new spin on John Locke's natural rights now, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. Mickey, I want to thank you so much for being here. I would love to have you come on every couple of months. My God, you're a gold.
I'd love to come on, John. I'd love to talk with you. It sounds like we have a lot to talk about, and it'd be an honor to be invited back. So anything I can do for you, I'd be happy.
Where can folks find your stuff? Where can folks find the 25 Most Censored? Tell them where they can locate this treasure of material.
Well, here's where you can go. You can go to projectcensored.org. You can see all our archive stories back to 1976, including a lot of the talks we do, our 6 years of radio shows, archived, 300 shows. You can go to our Global Critical Media Literacy Project if you're an educator or a student at gcml.org and get involved. And your listeners can contact me at mickey@projectcensored.org. That's Mickey like the mouse, of course. But certainly no Mickey Mouse politics going on with us at Project Censored. We need people to help support our work. We get $5, $10 a month subscriptions. People buy our book. We don't really get foundation grants. Well, you know why, John. Because of the things we talk about and the things we do. And we need all the people that we can to help get our word out and help support us. We've been educating generations of journalists for 40 years, and it seems like we still need to do it, maybe now more than ever.
What I'm going to do, Mickey, is I'm going to send you a link to the website about our film, The American Media and the Second Assassination.
Please do.
Okay, I'm going to send you that. I'm going to send you a minute trailer. The minute trailer itself would make you want to see it. If it is entirely possible, I would love to invite you and some of your students to be my guests, if you can get to Los Angeles, at the screening, or I will bring a DVD to Diablo, and I'll screen it for you for nothing and do a Q&A with your students.
Well, look, John, I'm going to take you up on that offer. Are you going to be in Las Vegas or Los Angeles?
Well, I live in Las Vegas, but for the week that the film is in Los Angeles, I'll be there for that entire week because I'm going to be doing – it opens 3 days before John Kennedy's 100th birthday. So Friday –
Okay, I'm interested. Let's talk off air. I would love to come down in L.A. and do that with you, and I would love to have you in the San Francisco Bay Area to screen your film. So let's talk.
Oh, that'd be wonderful, Mickey. Thank you so much. We're going to take a break right now, folks. We'll be back with Mickey's biggest fan, Joe Satilli. We'll be right back.
Great music from all the greatest performers from sunup to sundown.
How do you keep the music playing?
Great talk all night. The mysteries of UFOs, conspiracy theories, and the true story of Las Vegas that has never been told.
There are three ways to listen to KIYQ. Go to the TuneIn app, just search for KIYQ, or go to www.kiyq.org. Listen from any telephone, call 605-477-2857. That's 605-477-2857. Long distance charges may apply.
KIYQ 107.1.
John Barber of John Barber's World every other Monday at 5 p.m. Pacific right here on VBS Radio. I'm telling you about a terrific show, The New Criminal Minds with outstanding actor Gary Sinise, called Criminal Minds Beyond Borders, a tough drama about a special unit of the FBI involved in protecting Americans who are beyond borders. It follows the regular Criminal Minds, airing every Wednesday at 10 p.m. Eastern, 9 Central. Don't miss it. Gary Sinise is outstanding.
Hi, I'm Richard Belzer. This is the great VBS Radio.
Thank you for that smile upon your face, oh sunny.
Hi, this is John Barber. You may remember me as the co-host, producer, and creator of Real People, America's first reality show, or most recently as the writer-director of what's been called the definitive documentary on JFK's murder, The Last Word on the Assassination. Now I'm doing a show every other Monday from 5 to 6 Pacific Time on VBS. You'll hear provocative views, unreported news, and film reviews from me, with outstanding guests and you. Join me on John Barber's World.
You're listening to BBS Radio. If it's not mainstream, it's on bbsradio.com.
Those of you who have an ongoing interest in the JFK assassination might want to know about this. TV producer John Barber. He put together a dream team of JFK researchers, including Coast regular Jim Mars and world-class JFK writers Dick Russell and Joan Mellon. They all got together at UNLV in front of a live audience. They had a screening of Barber's terrific, and I'd say historic, film based on interviews with prosecutor Jim Garrison of New Orleans. And then after the film was shown, the experts all talked about the latest JFK theories and evidence. It's now out on a DVD. Terrific stuff. I'm George Knapp, Coast to Coast AM.
Welcome back to John Barber's World and my favorite person on my show all the time, Joe Sottile. Joe, today's newsman. Now, you know, I've been reading this for months and months and months, and I have never sent you a note about it, but I sent you a note today. That was just a fabulously interesting news vandal letter that you put out today.
It's some of it's luck, and some of it is luck, because you have to get, if the right things, pieces fit together, then it fits together the right way. I've been sitting on that thing about the dark secret at the heart of artificial intelligence for about 4 or 5 days, looking for the right day to use it. Because what I do when I put the rundown together is I try to start out with a piece that's not really just a general news piece. It's something that sort of sets the tone. And I thought the tone today was secrecy, because there's a lot there on Trump hiding who's coming in and out of the White House and all the lobbyists that are coming in as he swamps the drain with all of these crony capitalists. But the thing on an artificial intelligence was just that stood out to me, John, that what we have done is we have created deep learning machines, computers that have basically a neural structure that in many ways mimics our own neural structure. And when those machines start making decisions, like a self-driving car in New Jersey that starts driving without being programmed and making decisions based on it observing human beings, and we don't know how it's making those decisions, you start to realize the extent to which we are in a weird version of a Mary Shelley novel.
Well, can I ask you this question? If Trump is impeached, he may not, and they block the entrance of Pence to the White House. Is it possible to have one of these things installed in the Oval Office?
Well, you know, there have been a couple. I've seen a couple stories over the last 5 or 6 months of people pondering artificial intelligence politicians. Think about it, because they'll make perfectly rational decisions not based on the size of their election or whether
the,
or not.
I thought you were going to say the size of their hands.
Yeah, well, the size of their election, the size of their you-know-what, it's all the same thing for Donald Trump, which is the funny thing about Donald Trump. You know, John, you were mentioning, you know, what's going on with North Korea earlier and the impeachment possibly, you know, will Trump be impeached? I have it on somewhat good authority from a source I can't reveal that there is prison in the offing for some people involved in the Russiagate thing, and it's about money laundering. And I think Manafort is in deep, deep trouble, and Carter Page and some of these other guys are too. And you just can't help but wonder if all of a sudden the reason why North Korea is now front and center is because it delivers the grape. What I mean by that is there's an experiment where capuchin monkeys are given an opportunity. If you pull a lever, the right lever, you get a grape. If you pull the wrong lever, you get a cucumber piece. And the capuchin monkeys, if they both pull the same lever and one gets a grape and one gets a cucumber piece, the one that gets a cucumber piece gets really angry because they realize they're being rooked. Well, Donald Trump is like a capuchin monkey with a lever on a machine. And as long as he keeps getting that grape from doing what the military wants him to do and doing the strongman thing and showing the bluster and showing we mean business in North Korea and we're going to launch missiles in Syria, even though all we did is hit nothing. And even though the United States military, through deconfliction processes, actually told the Russians what was coming, and the Russians then told the Syrians, and then they kind of basically set it up so it's sort of like this wonderful little show missile strike. You know, you do just get the impression that this guy is so infinitely pliable that it's almost like a dream candidate or a dream president for the people who like to control the military. And that would be the people in the Pentagon who, by the way, John, I think the Pentagon has more power now than they've had since 1968 and the Tet Offensive, when the peak of Pentagon power started to come to an end, which led to, after that, was My Lai and the Pentagon Papers in 1971. The Pentagon is completely in control, and Donald Trump is more than happy to bask in the glow of what it means to have a bigger missile than anybody else on the planet.
What do you think is going to happen right now with Korea?
Here's the interesting thing. North Korea is not a threat in any existential way to the United States. North Korea is a threat to the people of South Korea, and it's certainly a threat to the people of Japan. One of the oddities here is that, you know, North Korea has been a wonderful little bargaining chip on some level for China. Now, the extent to which China can actually control North Korea is up for debate. They do have some power. But I think the real issue here is that that Trump and his administration is trying to make North Korea and the threat of North Korea front and center issue, because it pushes all the other issues out of the way. I'll give you one of those issues right now. Trump keeps his promises. That was a question that was just asked by Gallup in the last 24 hours. They published these results. In February, 62% of Americans said, yes, Trump keeps his promises. Now it's 45%. 45. Trump's approval rating is at 39 in the latest Pew poll, and a Investor's Business Daily poll just 2 days before he launched the Syria strike had his approval rating with independents. Now, the Investor's Business Daily poll is a right-leaning poll that tends to skew in favor of Republicans. They said 20% of independents approved of Donald Trump. 20%. So, you know, for him to have this issue be front and center is great politics. I think it might be bad international relations, because in many ways, all you have there is this sort of haphazard power that has secured nuclear weapons. Why? Because the lesson of Iraq was not, if you have weapons of mass destruction, we'll invade you. No, the lesson was, if you don't have weapons of mass destruction, will invade you. And the only way that you can really preserve yourself in America's world, the attempt for a new American century, which happened at the turn of the century, is to have weapons of mass destruction, which is one of the reasons why they happen. But can they actually, you know, menace the United States? No, they can't. Their missile program fizzled out again. Some people think that the United States has the ability to play with those missiles through electronic warfare and essentially cause them to fizzle out on the launch pad. I think that this has a lot to do with politics, and maybe more to do with politics than it does with national security.
If the United States had the ability electronically to blow up that rocket before it got 1,000 feet in the air, they would not be telling the world they had it, okay?
Of course not. Of course not. And K.T. McFarlane did – that's exactly what she did on Fox News Sunday yesterday when asked directly by Chris Wallace. And she said, well, I can't comment on that. She didn't deny it. She said, I can't comment on it. Now, if you can't do it and you wish people – thought you could do it, you wouldn't say that you couldn't do it. You'd have them still think that maybe you can do it by not commenting on it. But if you could do it, you also would kind of want them to think you can do it, but you wouldn't want to comment on it, so you play it both ways. But ultimately, I think the big takeaway here is the only people who are really in jeopardy of what Donald Trump, from what Donald Trump is trying to do, are the people along the DMZ, where we have the United States has thousands of troops stationed, and the people of South Korea who happen to live, and particularly Seoul, within shooting distance of massive artillery batteries on the other side of the 38th parallel. So it's kind of a dangerous game, but I think that Donald Trump is seeking a victory at any cost, because you know what Donald Trump likes, John? He loves big ratings.
Well, you know, North Korea, it would seem to me, it's a little bit like Vietnam back in the 50s when the French gave up Vietnam. They were going to hold elections in Vietnam, which the CIA and Eisenhower at first had agreed to. But then and Ho Chi Minh wrote a constitution which was very similar to our constitution. But when they found out that Ho Chi Minh would be enormously elected, they decided, no, we've got to get rid of him. It would seem to me, if the Koreans, North and South, had an opportunity to vote, I don't care if the North is communist and the South is not communist, they are Koreans before they're politicians. They would probably vote to have one country. Why don't we just get out of there and leave them alone?
Well, I mean, that's a great question. And I'll tell you what I think it's about is that the United States likes having 25,000 to 30,000 troops there on the Korean Peninsula to be a demonstration to China. Because it was, remember, you know, a lot of what happened that led up to McCarthyism was this whole hullabaloo after the end of World War II. Who lost China? And we lost China. Well, my gosh, all of these liberals and all of these progressives and these pinkos, these Alger Hiss types in the State Department lost China. As if China was something America had to give to lose, right? It wasn't China for the Chinese, no, because the China was for America. This is Claire Booth and Henry Luce and their obsession with, you know. Also, this goes back to the end of the 19th century, when people in the northeastern establishment thought, boy, if we could just sell a widget to everybody in China, we'd be rich for the rest of, you know, the rest of our lives. So this obsession with China is a big part of it. And now what we're finding in all these different ways, John, is that we are not able to come to grips with the fallout and the implications of, and I'm doing air quotes, winning the Cold War, because that Cold War win was a Pyrrhic victory, which caused a great deal of damage around the world and a great deal of damage to the American way and the perception of the American way
Joe, what we won was a fake Cold War.
Fake Cold War.
Garrison says it in the film, the Russians lost 25 million people. They were no threat to the United States. What was a threat to the United States was peace. Gore Vidal said it a million times. How many widgets can you manufacture?
Well, bullets. and also what was a danger was the desire for self-determination in nations all around the world who, when the United States did not side with self-determination of peoples, because why? Because FDR was gone and his four freedoms and his commitment, post-war commitment to self-determination, died with him. And when that silly little haberdasher from Missouri was put into the Oval Office, guys like who are just celebrate. I don't know why anybody celebrates Winston Churchill. Winston Churchill was a brutal racist and imperialist who, for some reason, we all celebrate. But if you go back and get into Winston Churchill's life, he's really not much of a human being, by the way.
I think he was one of those who sanctioned the leveling of Dresden in Germany, which killed just hundreds of thousands, if you call them innocent German civilians, for crying out loud. I mean, Doolittle said himself, you know, the 30 seconds over Tokyo with Spencer Tracy, but Doolittle said himself, we better win this bloody war, otherwise we're going to be hung as war criminals.
Well, that, you know what, I don't know if Doolittle said that, but I do know that General LeMay, Curtis LeMay, when he was plotting the firebombing of Tokyo with future Defense Secretary Robert McNamara, said to McNamara, and this is in the historical canon now, he said, if we were to lose this war, we would be hung as war criminals for doing to Tokyo what we are planning on doing right now.
That's right. So, and you know what?
So LeMay was one of the archetypes that Kubrick used in the making of Dr. Strangelove.
Exactly. And also, he had horrible arguments with John Kennedy because he wanted to use nukes in Vietnam.
Yeah. And, hey, he wanted to use the frogs, those little tactical nukes to take out the nukes that the Russians were putting into Cuba during the Bay of Pigs. Oh. I mean, LeMay, I mean, this guy is, you know, this is one of those. So here we are, just a little assessment. Right now, I think where we are as Americans with what's going on in North Korea and what happened in Syria is, in a strange way, John, we are actually banking on the sanity of the generals. The sanity of General McMaster at the National Security Council, the head of the lead National Security Advisor.
You know, when you see these guys now, though, the scary thing to me is they're not appearing in their uniforms. They appear on television in their suits and their ties, and underneath it gives them the Brigadier General so and so, but General so and so of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. I mean, it's like they're in hiding, for crying out loud. I would not trust anybody in the military. Look at Eisenhower, could have stopped the military-industrial complex himself. He was so popular with Americans. Instead, he left it to John Kennedy, who was only 43 years of age, for crying out loud.
But John, just a quibble here, because I think you actually might agree with this, is that actually, the scary thing is that Eisenhower probably couldn't stop it.
Well, you know, that's probably extremely true. You know, you're absolutely right. He could not stop it. He was in a position to, and he could not. Now, let me ask you.
I mean, this is the story of John F. Kennedy. This is actually the story of even of Nixon, who, if you, you know, the great Len Kolodny has done so much work to show that Bob Woodward was actually an intelligence agent working with from the Pentagon, who was dispatched to work with Alexander Haig. I, to this day, still believe that Alexander Haig was Deep Throat, and that Nixon was basically taken out because he was doing an end run around the Pentagon to come up with strategic arms limitation treaties with Russia, and also to the Soviet Union, and to make the opening to China, and they didn't like it. So
you were absolutely right, and that's one of the great untold stories about Richard Nixon. quite honestly. And I'm not very sympathetic or empathetic to the man. He just seemed awfully cold to me. But, you know, at the height of the Vietnam demonstrations, he had the guts to go out on the street and talk to these people. Now, speaking of talking and going out in the streets, because of what happened last week in Korea, there were all kinds of, it looked like demonstrations in Berkeley and around the country. I did not understand what it was about. What was it about? Were they?
Well, these are two separate things. One is the Trump release your taxes demonstrations. And and I the one thing about Trump's taxes is we don't know who he owes money to. And I know we know that he owes $300 million to Deutsche Bank, and Deutsche Bank has multiple investigations going on right now in the Justice Department, and he owes money to Deutsche Bank. That's a conflict of interest. The who he owes money to is one of the things that people want to know. The thing that happened in Berkeley, though, is a different and perhaps more troubling, where you have the alt-right, basically a new form of kind of American neo-Nazi going up against radical left-wing anarchists. And this had nothing, in many ways, had nothing to do with what was going on with the tax protests. It just happened to be timed in a sense, or it wasn't, it was slightly coincidental. Let's put it that way. And we are seeing a very, very violent kind of oppositional politics happening in the United States right now, and we do have actually neo-Nazis in this country.
Well, we have lots of them, and I think Donald Trump's election has unleashed a lot of them. My son, who works on a very popular television show on CBS, said that he is now noticing a lot of friction between some of the whites who make, you know, $150,000 a year, and some of the blacks who make $100,000 or $150,000 a year, workers on the sets, these tensions are rising. Joe, your news vandal was wonderful. You have a really interesting story there about these demonstrations in Berkeley. Tell folks where they can hear you again, I guess on Ocelli, and where to get your news vandal.
Yeah, Ocelli tomorrow night from 6 to 7 on American Freedom Radio. Just go to newsvandal.com. A little box will pop up. You can sign up and you'll get the daily news vandal. And John, as ever, just great to be with you. What a wonderful conversation you had with Mickey. And folks, get ready. The film is coming. Second Assassination of John F. Kennedy. American Media. It's coming. It's coming.
Well, thank you so much, Joe. I want to thank also Mike Kim, my producer, truthfully, without whom I would not do this show, and Don and Doug Newsom, the owners of DBS Radio. And to all of you, thanks so much. And in 2 weeks, Joe Satilli and I are going to do the entire hour, and we're going to open the phone so you can tune in and talk to us. Till then, good night. And good luck.
You're my spark of nature's fire. You're my sweet, complete desire. A sunny, 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 sunny.